از پشت دریچه های بسته دیدی پرنده پر زد و رفت. در خانه غم نشسته بودیم دیدیم که بخت در زد و رفت. زندانی شام تیره بودیم دیدیم که ماه سر زد و رفت. گفتیم که این چه روزگار است دیگر نه زمان انتظار است. هم اینک وقت کارزار است. هم اینک وقت کارزار.
Welcome to the show. I'm Michael Slate and this is the Michael Slate Show. And that was Gisu Shakiri with her song Karzar, which means battle. The time for battle is now. A really moving song, and she brings so much of importance and of feeling and of, you know, just inspiration in her songs. And this is sort of going to be the theme of a large part of today's show, is International Women's Day. Our show today is going to be heavy and got to be operate like a clock. Okay, in the back end of the show, we'll be talking with the director and one of the actors from The Ballad of Emmett Till. We're also going to have a poet come in and do a really, really fantastic poem. I was really impressed with this poem, and I'm going to keep that as a little surprise until we do it. Kicking the show off, I'm very, very pleased to welcome to the show today Susan Gol, who's a representative of the March 8th Women's Organization, Iran and Afghanistan, and Tina, who is recently left Iran a few months back. She's a young woman who basically just came of political age during the whole recent upsurge. And we're going to be talking about that, the life of young women in Iran, the life of women in Iran, the struggle around that. So I want to welcome both of you to the show. Nice having you here. Tina, Susan.
Hi.
Hi. Now, Susan, I know you're an old expert at this, so we'll start off with you. Why don't you tell people a little bit about the March 8th Women's Organization, Iran and Afghanistan?
با سلام به همه شنوندگان عزیز. خوشحالم که دوباره اینجا هستم و چیزهایی رو که سال قبل گفتم به یک سری مسائل رو که سال قبل گفتم رسیدیم و 9 ماه مبارزه مردم ایران، زنان و مردان ایران تو خیابونه که همیشه ازش صحبت کردیم و الان اومدیم که جشن این مبارزه و جشن ستم دیدگان رو با هم بگیریم.
Greeting to all. I'm so happy to be here, and especially with the occasion of what is developing in Iran. I've been here last 2 years, and I have talked about the possibility of the occasion like that. And this last 9 months actually has expressed what we were anticipating. It was real that the men and women have poured into the street and struggling and fighting back.
سازمان 8 مارس سازمان زنان هست که در رابطه با سازمان 8 مارس ایران افغانستان مبارزات خودش رو در حدود 12 سال هستش که در رابطه با ستم و زن در خاورمیانه و در جهان شروع کرده و مبارزات خیلی زیادی رو ارگانایز کردیم، از سخنرانی های مختلف، راهپیمایی های بزرگ و اکسیون های مختلف که فقط صدای نه تنها زنان ستم دیده در خاورمیانه رو به مردم برسونیم، این مسئله رو با ستم جهانی، ستم زنان که جهانی هستش وصل بکنیم و خودمون رو در ارتباط با دنیا و زنان دنیا بیشتر نزدیکتر کنیم.
March 8th organization is a woman organizations of Iran and Afghanistan, and we have been working and struggling for last 12 years against the oppression of women primarily in Middle East, but at the same time in the whole world. This organization has gone through many, many years of struggle, have brought forward all kinds of actions and speaking tours and conferences to raise the voice of the people of Middle East, but at the same time connect with the common struggle that the women of the world are going through, and this would be the world's struggle.
Tina, welcome to the show, Tina.
Thank you.
Sure. Why don't we talk a little bit about your experience? I'm going to get back to Suzanne in a minute and talk about her experience. But I wanted, how do you see the situation in Iran today for young women? What is the situation in Iran?
تجربه تو و اوضاع فعلی چی هست؟
اول تشکر میکنم از اینکه من تو این برنامه هستم و میتونم صدامو به دنیا برسونم. تجربه من در مورد اتفاقات اخیر خب هم یه بخشش ناراحت کننده است، یه بخشش خوشحال کننده است، برای اینکه بالاخره ما تونستیم خودمون رو به جهان معرفی کنیم و اصلا اینکه بگیم که ما ایرانی هستیم، هنوز زنده ایم و برای زنده بودن تلاش میکنیم.
I'm so happy to be here to bring my voice and voice of the people to the whole world that what's going on in Iran. Part of the story that I'm going to share with you is very, very, very sad. But the other part is very strengthening, very beautiful. And it is the kind of situation that we feel that we are alive. For a very, very long time, we didn't feel like that. But now we feel that we are alive, and we want to show that to the people of the world where we are.
I'm going to go back and forth between the two of you, actually. So, Suzanne, why don't you tell people a little bit about your experience, who you are, what you came, you know, what your experience has been. You're part of that generation that was there fighting against the Shah and was part of the whole revolution in 79 and the period afterwards. And then tell people what your experience has been.
همونطور که بعضی از شما هنوز میدونین، من در دو انقلاب ناظر مبارزه در دو انقلاب مختلف هستم. براندازی یک سیستم سلطنتی امپریالیستی و اینکه به شوق اینکه با آگاهی و فعالیتی که در رابطه با ماهیت شاه و به عنوان سگ زنجیری امپریالیسم آمریکا بود، به این امید که مسئولیت خودم رو در رابطه با پیشبرد این مسئله که ما چه سیستمی رو میخوایم و چه انقلابی رو باید داشته باشیم، بعد از انقلاب 57 به ایران رفتم و در اونجا با برخورد و حرکت سیستمی که خمینی سوار بر انقلاب ما شد و تونست اون رو به کمک دولت خارجی و امپریالیسم آمریکا تصویب بکنه، چون دست اونا رو بازی میکرد برای کشتار مبارزین و سازمانها و سرکوب و استبداد در خدمت اونها قرار گرفت، اومد و اولین حکم خودش رو که زن باید حجاب داشته باشه در ایران رو مطرح کرد و مبارزه من اونجا به صورت خیلی کانکریت و مشخص شروع شد.
Yeah, as some of you may know, I have participated in two different struggle, two different trains of revolution. One it was the toppling of the monarchy, puppet of the US imperialism, the Shah, but also what it is developing right now and the possibility of the future revolution. This is what took place at that time, that I felt so great to be able to be part of the future, building the society in our countries. I flew back immediately after the revolution. She told me actually the first plane that was available, she actually jumped on it and she went back to Iran to be able to be with people and be able to actually develop a beautiful future. But because of the many different reasons, a lot of backdealing between the imperialists and Khomeini was able finally to establish his power and started his power with the killing of the revolutionaries and dismantling organization. And the first thing that he started, that it was not even a month after the revolution, was enforcing the compulsory hijab on people.
من و زنان و هزاران هزار زن، 15,000 تا 30,000 زن به خیابون اومدیم و فریاد زدیم ما انقلاب نکردیم تا به عقب برگردیم. و من و خانواده‌ام از همان روز تکلیفمون با جمهوری اسلامی مشخص شده بود، ولی متاسفانه زنان ما که این مسئله رو خیلی زودتر از بقیه جامعه فهمیدند، با سکوت بقیه و با نظارت بقیه این مسئله رو به بهای بسیار گرونی تا به حال پرداختیم.
Immediately after Khomeini tried to enforce that hijab on people, which is a head-to-toe cover, we poured into the street tens of thousands, 15, 20, 30 thousands of women mainly took to the street. We said we didn't make revolution to go backward. We made revolution to go forward. What is this? But it was very hard because there were a lot of people who were not clear what's going on. And basically, they were silent about it and acted complicit. And we paid a heavy, heavy price for that.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking now with Susan Gol and Tina, two Iranian women, one who was involved in the struggle, as you've just heard, from the time of the struggle against the Shah and then continued on struggling against the Khomeini regime, and Tina, who is younger and has just come into a lot of the struggle inside Iran. Tina, let me ask you this, and we'll get back to you in a minute, Susan, but let me ask you this, Tina. Susan was talking about the hijab law and that women came out into the streets and they said, we didn't make revolution to go backwards. How do the younger generation of women look at this in Iran now?
خب این اتفاقی که افتاد، یعنی این که حجاب اجباری که گذاشته شد حتی قبل از اینکه خیلی از ما به دنیا بیایم، انتخابی بود که برای ما گرفته شد، انتخابی بود که ما نداشتیم، در واقع از ما گرفته شده بود. ما تمام این سالها با حجاب دست و پنجه نرم کردیم، یعنی اینکه برای اینکه یه جورایی هم به یه مشت محکمی بزنیم به نظام حاکم که ما حجابو نمیخوایم، به قول اونها بد حجاب یا بی حجاب بودیم. یعنی در تمام دوران زندگیم، از وقتی که من توی قانون اسلامی از 9 سالگی دختر به سنی میرسه که باید حجاب داشته باشه، توی تمام این مدت ما سعی کردیم با پوششمون و با اونجوری که دلمون میخواست که هیچ وقت نتونستیم، ولی خب تا اونجایی که میتونستیم با پوششمون نشون دادیم که ما این حجاب اجباری رو نمیخوایم و الان در حال حاضر به صورت متبلور شده ای میبینیم که تو خیابونا، حتی توی تظاهراتی که اخیراً اتفاق افتاده توی عاشورا، زنا حجابشون رو برداشتن و جاهایی دیدیم حتی آتیش زدن. و حتی توی سالای، فکر میکنم سال 64 یا 65 به تاریخ شمسی بود، که یک زن برای اینکه بگه که من از این حجاب بیزارم، خودش و حجابش رو با هم به آتش کشید.
This forced hijab was decided before even I was born. This is not something I chose. This was chosen for me. And from the get-go, I hated, and I hated so bad, this hijab, the forced hijab on us. And we became to figure out what to do about it. We tried to figure out what to do about it. And they called us people with the bad hijab or bi hijab, meaning your hijab is not actually good or somehow is lacking something. And this was the way in which we were fighting against these Islamic laws, that the hijab is woven in it. So we went and did a lot of different things. And today you would see the expression of that, that is being crystallized in the streets of Iran, that women throwing their covers out and even burning that. And as a matter of fact, there is a story that actually Tina shared with me before we come here, and I want to explain a little bit deeper on that, is that a woman right in the middle of the square, about 10 years or so ago, you know, she went out there, took the hijab out and burned the hijab and shouted, I want revolution, I want freedom, I want independence, and she burned herself as well.
Susan, you talked about women paying a heavy price. And it's both women, as you spoke to, very, very, and I think both you and Tina are speaking to it in terms of the intensity of it in an overall question. But I want people to know that you also suffered a very personal price, paid a very high personal price. You were yourself arrested and tortured, and your husband was executed at the hands of the regime as part of the execution of, what, tens of thousands of Iranian revolutionaries by the Khomeini regime. And in fact, by Mousavi, who everybody is always cheering for these days, had a big hand in all that. And I wanted you to talk a little bit here about, well, basically, you know, there's this whole thing of the struggle. Now, people see it in the street. There's a lot of people taking heart. They're looking at it. And there's a lot of upsurge. But still, you know, the regime still holds on. And what's being put forward as the hope for the Iranian people is the Green Movement. And I wanted you to speak to that a little bit. But before we do that, I want to remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. And as part of International Women's Day this year, that's what the show is about today. And this is a special holiday this year in particular, because all over the world, women and men are marching in solidarity with the women warriors of Iran, and actually all of the Iranian people, who are struggling against both the Islamic regime and the other gigantic oppressive power in the world, U.S. imperialism. And we're talking today with Suzanne Gol and Tina, two women from Iran. Suzanne was active against the Shah of Iran and continued to struggle for liberation against the Khomeini regime and the Islamic Republic. Suzanne's husband was executed, and she and her family were arrested and tortured by this regime. Tina is a young woman who grew up and came to political consciousness and struggle under the Islamic fundamentalist regime. So now let's get back into our conversation. Let's talk about the Green Movement and what is, we're constantly told that the Green Movement is somehow the hope for the people of Iran. What do you think of that?
خیلی خلاصه بگم که شکاف بین دو قسمت حکومت با برنامه فرستادن مردم به طرف صندوق‌های رأی فقط برای خودشون پایه‌هایی رو ایجاد کنن مردم رو به خیابون ریختن، ولی مسئله این بود که دروغ‌هاشون و افتضاحایی که برای افشا کردن همدیگه رو شد و کلایی که سر مردم خواستن بذارن، مردم خشمگین‌تر از این حرفا بودن. خشم مردم 31 سال هستش که وجود داره و این باعث شد که شکست، جو شکست و مردم به خیابون اومدن. در میون اونا شما رنگ سبزی رو هم میبینین که همه جا مطرح شده. این رنگ سبز دو تا انگیزه داره. یه انگیزش این هستش که مردم فکر میکنن برای همبستگی و اتحاد با هم دیگه این سبز رو با هم داشته باشن، ولی واقعیتش این نیست. واقعیتش این هستش که رهبرایی که این سبز رو دارن رهبری میکنن کاملا ارتجاعی هستن و یکی از اونها موسویه، کسی که 10 سال اول روز اول انقلاب رئیس جمهور بود و باعث مرگ هزاران هزار از مبارزین بود، باعث مرگ همسر من، باعث زندانی شدن من و امثال من و هزاران نفر دیگه بود. کسی هستش که عاشقانه جمهوری اسلامی رو دوست داره.
I would like to briefly explain what is going on. There is a very deep contradiction within the ruling class amongst two different factions. And one of the things they did, they tried to actually solve this contradiction through fooling people, bringing people to, you know, into the street and expressing that there is a democracy, the sham democracy in Iran. But this lies and deceits actually that was supposed to hold people down, it created the kind of situation that people took advantage of that and expressed themselves into the street against the 31 years of oppression and exploitation. And this green collar that you might say, or the green movement, there is a two different aspects to it. One is that amongst the masses, people are actually using this collar for the color of the unity, the together, being together against the whole establishment. But in reality, what it is, the leadership of the green people like Mousavi, these are criminals. Mousavi has been very much participating in the first decade of the Islamic Republic in Iran. He actually was the cause of many laws and at the same time imprisonment of many that some of my loved ones were part of it and myself included. And he was presiding over the situation when my husband was executed. This is what's going on. And he very clearly expresses that he really truly loves Islamic Republic of Iran. I'm going to add to that that yeah, he actually said not Islamic Republic of Iran, not a word more and not a word less.
Tina, how are the younger people in Iran today looking at this Green Movement? And I know you yourself actually, and we're going to have to I have a couple more questions that I want to ask, we're going to be pushing through this, so we're going to extend it a little bit. But how are you know, the younger people looking at Mousavi, the Green Movement, the struggle? I mean, you yourself, actually, it's interesting because, you know, you're dressed very fashionably right now. Did you dress this way when you were in Iran?
بله من درسم همین جوری، یعنی همین جوری که نبود، ولی خب من همین کلاهی که الان گذاشتم و روی روسریم هم همین کلاهو میذاشتم. این کلاهو من از ایران با خودم آوردم.
She was saying that she's, as Michael was saying, she's very fashion, you know, what she, really, really beautiful.
I like the hat. Let me put it that way.
And, and she has a special hat that you got to just see it. I definitely cannot explain how it looks like. And she said she wearing actually this one. And she was wearing that on top of her veil. And that was a no-no.
در مورد موسوی موزه من کاملا مشخصه. آقای موسوی نخست وزیر جمهوری اسلامی بودند، جمهوری که ریشه هاش با خون آدمای عزیز و بزرگی از ایران آبیاری شده. غیر قابل وصفه، اصلا توی احساس آدم نمی گنجه. آقای موسوی کسی هستند که با خون معرفی میشن برای من و خطشون کاملا برای من مشخصه. ایشون گفتن جمهوری اسلامی، نه یک کلمه کمتر نه یک کلمه بیشتر. ایشون با زبون خودشون دارن میگن من همون جمهوری اسلامی رو میخوام که هست، و مدام توی صحبتاشون تکرار میکنن که چقدر جای خمینی خالیه. خب همینقدر برای من کافیه که وقتی که اسم آقای خمینی میاد، جنایت، قتل عام، شکنجه، خفقان و سر به نیست کردن بسیاری از آدمایی که حتی خانواده هاشون هنوز نمیدونن جنازه هاشون کجاست، اینا همه تداعی کننده حکومتیه که آقای موسوی میخواد بیاره.
It's clear Mousavi was the prime minister of the Islamic Republic of Iran when all this happened. The Islamic Republic of Iran is nurturing by the blood of beautiful people in Iran, and it is very hard to explain that. Sometimes I cannot become really speechless. He has repeatedly expressed Islamic Republic of Iran, not a word more, not a word less. He constantly reminds us that he is in love with Khomeini, and he wishes to bring back what Khomeini was really representing. And what was that? That he is missing today. Killings, rapes, torture, disappearances of the people who were killed, and nobody knows where they were buried. This is what Mousavi is today, and this is what Mousavi was yesterday.
All right, let's move into now, and let's talk about, I want to ask, and I think Susanna, I'll ask you this, you know, there's a point about the importance of what's going on in Iran today, and what difference does it make that the women have stood up in Iran? What difference does it make that the Iranian people are standing up around it, women and men together? You know, can you speak to that? Just give people a sense of what's the importance of what's happening there today.
مسئله خیلی مهمی که برای زنان هست، ستم بر زن، پایه‌های اصلی این حکومت جمهوری اسلامی و بنیادگراییه. و اگر ما زنان که 31 ساله داریم باهاش کلنجار میریم، اگر ما زنان این پایه ها رو، یعنی رها بشیم، پایه های این حکومت رو زیر پا گذاشتیم. و به خاطر همینم هم هست سرنوشت ما زنان ایران و ما زنان خاورمیانه با سرنوشت دنیا به هم مربوط میشه، چون سیستم بنیادگرایی سیستمی هستش که کنترل تمام دنیا رو از یک طرف و پایه سرمایه داری و سیستم امپریالیسم که پایه سرمایه داری هست و کنترل زنان و ستم بر زن رو داره با هم مشترکن، و اینو ما باید بدونیم. برای همین هستش که مسئله رهایی زن یک مسئله سرنوشت ساز و حیاتی میشه.
Our liberation and now the oppression of women in Iran, as was said earlier, they are the roots of, the basis of, the pillars of the Islamic Republic. Our liberation, the liberation of the woman, is equal with the destruction of this system, taking the pillars away. But at the same time, our destiny is woven with the other women all over the world, particularly that the destiny that's of the, you know, of the people in the region, because of the Islamic fundamentalism and because of the foreign power, who both share the same keeping people down, and they share the same value of the oppression of the woman. And that has brought us together, and our struggle, women of the world, has become a common struggle as well.
Let me ask you this, because I think, you know, part of what I see there, and I think part of what you're saying in that comment is the idea that, you know, what the women in Iran are doing is really they're saying, and I think the Iranian people as a whole, they're saying, look, we don't have to settle for either Islamic fundamentalism or for U.S. imperialism, that neither one represents anything for people. And you're open, and there's a whole new doorway being opened up in the world concretely, which to me is really something that, you know, this kind of struggle that's there now doesn't exist anywhere else in the world right now. And what difference can it make to people? So, I wanted to make that point as we move along, and we are going to have to rush a little bit. But I did want to say, you know, one of the things I know, Suzanne, I don't know if you went also, Tina, but you went to Crenshaw High School earlier in the week. Why don't you tell people a little bit about what it was like bringing your story and a story of the struggle in Iran to the youth at Crenshaw High School?
من تو مدرسه کرنشو که رفتم جوونا رو دیدم که چقدر کنجکاوم و علاقمند هستن که در خاورمیانه در ایران چی میگذره. به خواهران و برادرانشون اونجا چجوری میگذره. من برای اونا تعریف کردم دختر و پسرای ما تو مدرسه نمیتونن در کنار همدیگه درس بخونن. ما در دانشگاه ها زنا پشت مردا باید توی جدا از همدیگه باشن و هیچ نوع ارتباطی با هم نداشته باشن. ما حتی اتوبوس هامونم زنون مردون است. یعنی زنا باید عقب بشینن، یه دیوار گذاشتن، مردا جلو. یعنی اگر خانوادگی میرن زنا باید عقب بشینن و شوهراشون جلو. اینجا رو فکر میکنم شباهت هایی رو شما در گذشته به این مسئله میتونین خودتون حدس بزنین که چه شباهتی با این مسئله داره و شرایطی که به هیچ عنوان زن به هیچ عنوان به عنوان یک انسان دیده نشه، به عنوان یک وسیله، به عنوان یک ابزار، به عنوان یک اشیا باش برخورد بکنه.
Yeah, it was beautiful when we went to the high school. You have young kids sitting there curious about what's going on in Middle East and what is the situation there that most of them didn't know that much about. And I told them about the situation in Iran amongst the girls and boys in the elementary schools and high schools, how they are actually forced to be separated, even going to the higher level education, that is the same thing. Buses, when we actually, even with the whole family that is taking a journey from one end of the city to another, they have to sit there separately. Women sit in the back and the men in the front, and there's a wall in between. And this brought a lot of questions, a lot of thinking amongst people, and many people, I'm adding this part, they talked about segregation. Many people, you know, we asked them, does it remind you anything? And people said, Rosa Parks. And that was a very, very significant. And we went into and talked about how the woman is being dealt with as a property.
You know, one of the things that always stands out to me around this is that, and especially when you're making that comparison with the oppression of black people in this country, there's the point about the denial of the humanity of women. Really, what's going on there with the oppression of women is actually robbing the humanity of fully, of one half or more of the human species is being declared inhuman. That seems to be a lot of what people have to actually get about what's going on with all this. I want to ask you both, and I'll start with you, Suzanne. Why is it important for people to celebrate International Women's Day this year?
علت اومدن زنای آمریکایی، مردای آمریکایی به این جشن، اولا اینکه روز جهانی زن، روز بین‌المللی 8 مارس روز جهانی زن رو ما از مبارزات زنان آمریکایی که در گذشته این روز رو در واقع پایه‌گذاری کردن یاد گرفتیم. این روز روز جهانیه. این روز روز شماست. روز ما ایرانیان نیست. روز همه ما هستش و اینکه ما فقط به خاطر دستاورد این مبارزات چند ماهه‌ای که ما این جو رو شکستیم، جو استبداد و زور و ستم رو شکستیم و می‌خوایم به شما نشون بدیم که امکان پذیره. این امکان پذیر هستش که ما دنیایی رو به دست خودمون و این شروع کاره دنیایی رو به دست خودمون داشته باشیم و دو تا سیستمی که در مقابلمون هست هر دو این سیستم رو جدا بذاریم. وجود شما شکستن این جو هست، وجود شما این هستش که ارتباط جهانی این مسئله رو ستم زن رو نشون میده و اینکه قدرتی که در شما هست، من با شما حرف دارم نه با هیلری کلینتون. خانم هیلری کلینتون نمیتونه به من آزادی بده، ادعای آزادی میده، با اسلحه هاش، با برنامه هاش توی افغانستان، توی عراق آزادی دارن میبرن؟ با اسلحه چی دارن میبرن اونجا؟ خانم کلینتون بهتره بشینه و حرف نزنه، به خاطر اینکه ما آزادی رو به دست خودمون میگیریم.
Yes, here what we are talking about is a March 8 International Women's Day. This is not an Iranian day. This belongs to the women of the world. As a matter of fact, the history of this International Women's Day goes back to here in this country, when women workers here in this country rose up. And that is what we're celebrating. That is what we are coming out. And we are really calling men and women to come and join us in this struggle. One of the key things we want to do is to bring the lessons and experience of the last month. There are a lot of beautiful lessons that can be made that we can change things. We can change future. We can bring future. We can bring forward another world against these two monsters that we talked earlier. I would like to add that I forgot this part that actually she also talking about. The Hillary Clinton and like Obama included, I'm adding this part, is that they are not capable of, and that is not what they are doing, bringing freedom. How could you bring freedom with the armed man in those countries? I would like to tell her to just, you know, stay and shut up. And this is the future that we are fighting. And the freedom is not something that somebody gives you. Freedom is something you have to take.
And I think that's a good way to kind of wrap the interview up, which was that it's not just the question, as important as it is to stand against what's going on, the oppression of women in Iran, it's important to recognize that there is an imperialist system, and at the head of this system right now in the world is U.S. imperialism, which doesn't offer anything but even more severe oppression and repression for women all over the world, including women right here. And that the, again, this is the one half of humanity being held in chains, and that's the important reason. And frankly, one of the most important things, I think one of the most important expressions of solidarity that people can make is actually standing with the Iranian people, the Iranian women, shoulder to shoulder, standing with them and saying, and giving strength to this position in the world that says, look, we do not have to settle for one or the other oppressor, that we can stand up and we can actually fight to emancipate women and emancipate, you know, the world. And to me, it's actually, that's a very important point. Tina, I want to thank you very much for being here. Suzanne, I want to thank you very much for being here. We've been talking to Suzanne and Tina, two Iranian women who are involved in a struggle against the Islamic fundamentalist regime in Iran and who are telling the world that we do not need to stay imprisoned inside a box defined by any oppressive regime or system, neither the Islamic fundamentalism nor U.S. imperialism. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're going to take a quick break and be right back with our next guest, Nargis Kestu, and her quick but very cool poem, so stay tuned.
There's gonna be a brighter tomorrow, happiness and no more sorrow. Everybody's gonna love one another, just spread love and we live like brothers. When I build my world,
all right, welcome back. This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And that was Jimmy Lewis with his piece, When I Build My World, taken from his album, Give the Poor Man a Break. I'm very happy to welcome my next guest to the show. She is Nargis Kestu, a young poet, and she's here to read a refreshingly defiant poem on the oppression of women around the world. And this is a person who some friends of mine bumped into you as when you came into Revolution Books.
Yeah.
And you said, I have a poem. And you said, it's on YouTube. And they checked it out, and it was, wow. What a great poem.
Thank you.
And it's Nargis Kestu, and I want you to jump.
Kestu.
I knew I'd get the pronunciation wrong, but I'll get it right next time. Kestu.
Okay.
Nargis, This is a poem about the oppression of women. It's for International Women's Day.
Yeah.
For, okay.
Inspired by women in general.
Okay. Okay. Go
Here
to
we
it.
Go. I am woman. Hear me roar! With a voice too loud to ignore. Coming with stories never heard before. We deserve respect of this, I'm sure. In a little while, you'll realize our strength is hardcore. Society deems women emotional, unstable, and inferior. They never praise their insides or base their worth on their interior. Well, we're here to let you know we are more than just our exteriors. In fact, in many aspects, we are even superior. All men have the same emotions women do. The only difference is that women's emotions are not subdued. We are woman enough to show our emotions. To say we are unstable or weak for this is a silly notion. To think we are incapable of success in physics, math, and business is an abomination. To say we are inferior to sciences is a lazy generalization. Have you ever stopped to consider the misleading processes of acculturation? From this myth, we decree our emancipation. And no, we want to aspire to society's deceptive, aggressive, discriminative, maladaptive expectations. We are women, such beautiful, compassionate creatures. And I assure your looks are not your most beautiful features. You are not a number on the scale. You are not delicate. You are not frail. You are not here for the entertainment of males. And from the cages of idealizations of beauty, we will prevail. Throughout history, women have been oppressed in countless ways. Daily struggles of objectification and discrimination we face every day. In relationships and with people, we are taught to please and obey. Well, we're here to let you know that these unreasonable demands are not okay. No, I'm not going to sugarcoat things. This is what I believe. From my experience and studies, this is what I've perceived. Worldwide rights for women is what we must strive to achieve. For the idea and notion of the submissive, passive woman, you shall grieve. Our opinion, intellect, and voice we shall not hide. For the respect of our thoughts and minds is what we strive. For the liberations of hands still tied. And no, this is not about picking sides. We acknowledge that we are equal, although we are different. But for our dissimilarity, we shall not suffer such cruel punishment. Our differences, although equivalent, are there to complement the strengths and weaknesses of men, which formulates congruence. Womanhood is something we must celebrate. It is a woman's mind and heart we should appreciate. And disrespect and inequality we shall not tolerate. Our strength and power you better not underestimate. And no, we are not jealous of your penis.
Nargis Kestu. Thank you very much. Very, very important.
Thank
very
you. Important.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with the director and lead actor in the play The Ballad of Emmett Till. So stay tuned. Welcome back. That was the Hypnotic Brass Ensemble, and it was Emmett Till. And I'm really pleased to welcome to the show right now the director, Shirley Jo Finney.
Hi.
And Lorenz Arnell.
Hello.
Hi. Who plays Emmett Till. And it's a play that I saw on opening night, and I was stunned. I was just stunned. And people know the story of Emmett Till. If you don't, you should. Murdered for whistling at a white woman in Mississippi. And I'd say, actually, I'd recommend that if you want to get a concentrated lesson in the story of Emmett Till, you can go to revolutiontalk.net, where you'll find an excerpt from a speech by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And that excerpt is called They're Selling Postcards of the Hanging, and it includes a very powerful piece on Emmett Till. The Emmett Till piece is also available by itself as a separate clip. And it's just an incredible. And this is the play. And the play, it's a really, really great play. And I'm really happy you guys are here to talk with us about it today. So I'll start off first with Shirley.
Oh, how?
I was going for it. Lorenz is sitting back there going, yeah, he's going to go.
I know. As I hurriedly put on my headphones and at the microphone.
Shirley.
Yes.
really complex story, and it seems a really intense story to fashion into a play. And I know that that Aoife, the playwright, actually had talked about this. The changes constantly. How did you approach this? How did you see this play when you were handed it? And you really walked into it at the last minute.
Absolutely.
You know, so why don't you tell the story?
Well, the story was that the original director, Bryn Bradley, who was one of the associates at the Fountain Theater as producer-director and was well-known in the community, lobbied for this play. He loved this play, and he had talked to Stephen Sacks saying, we need to do this show. The first time the show was presented was at the Goodman Theater, and it had a cast of 13. It was a linear show, and it had it was a mixed cast between white actors and black actors, and Aoife had always wanted to condense it and have it be more of a lyrical choreo poem. And so when the Fountain decided to do it, they were like 3 days, the cast was 3 days in rehearsal. And on the 1st of January, Bryn Bradley was murdered. And so I found that out on the 2nd. And on the 3rd, I was in a rehearsal hall. And so it was one of those things where, unfortunately, they hadn't gotten, you know, the design team hadn't started building and everything, so I could reconceptualize. But, you know, we all, through the cast and myself, we all had to work through almost like a traumatic shock, because their leader was no longer there. And here I am coming shepherding and being the midwifing this project.
Let me ask you this, because and as intense an experience that was, you know, you had to step back and actually you had to wrestle this project. You had to actually put your arms around it and make it yours to a certain extent.
Yes.
That process, it seems to me it's extremely, extremely intense to try and tell this mythic, this iconic story that still resonates today. And as Aoife made the point that the play kept changing, as even after she wrote it,
right,
it's changed so dramatically.
Exactly.
You know, in terms of, and even moving it from a bigger theater to a smaller theater, but even in the storytelling itself, this is a story that doesn't end.
Right,
you
right.
know, and not just in the particular expression, but in the things that are happening to people, i.e., UC San Diego.
Absolutely,
you know?
Absolutely.
That's a verbal lynching.
Exactly.
You know,
and you
think about this, so what was it like to do that, to actually wrestle with this story?
Well, one of the things that I approached the piece was because it was very easy when Aoife had reduced it to 5 people. And I'm always about signs and symbols, and 5 means change. And also about trains. I looked at, when I first read it, the idea of trains resonated for me because it was always about migration. Trains are always moving from one point of consciousness to another point of consciousness. And in the African-American experience, trains are very significant from the rural to the urban migration. And so that's where I started in terms of shaping the piece. And also because in this piece, Emmett is spirit come back. And in the retelling of this story, it is now 2010. And like you said, in the state of consciousness where everyone is disconnected, there's xenophobia, there's all of these different fear-based consciousness that's happening in our society. I think it's a very timely story to tell about Emmett Till. And one of the things about that I thought was wonderful and that Aoife and I were formatting was Emmett Till is about a life. It is about a celebration of a life. And I think one of the things when you come to the theater, people always are addressing the event. They don't know the event, the iconic event of Emmett Till. They don't know Emmett Till, the spirit, Emmett Till, the human being. He was a young boy of 14. A whole life ahead of him. But he was a young boy who had a foundation that his mother, Mamie, laid before him in terms of this zest for living. He overcame polio. He overcame so many physical and emotional obstacles, and he didn't let life stop him. And I think that was one of the things that was to his strength of why they couldn't stop him.
Let me ask Lorenz something here. I told you the night when I saw the play, and I'll tell you what, man. That was the first time I ever passed up food that looked as good as it did that night. You're talking chicken and potatoes. Yeah. I was like, whoa. But I wanted to talk to you because you brought Emmett Till to life so fiercely.
Thank you.
You really captured a lot. And the whole way you carried yourself and the idea, some of the stuff that Shirley was just talking about, what Emmett Till was, and including the defiance, which I thought actually was a very important part. I'll talk a little bit about him in a minute. Mm-hmm. But did you know about Emmett Till when you first took the part?
I knew of Emmett Till's death, as many people did. I didn't know to the extent once I got into the play and did my research. I didn't know like that, but I did know of his death, not of his life, no.
And when you did your research, and again, because you captured, maybe it's just the fact that you're a young black man in America, and so there's a universality there in that particularity. But the fact is that you brought so much. I mean, and I want you to do, I think you're prepared to do a scene from this today?
Yes.
Is that true? Okay.
Yes.
I want you to do that in just a minute, because I want people to get a sense of what you brought to Emmett Till. You brought him to life in a way that I had never really seen before. I thought just the sparkle and the defiance, and including actually one of the things, like I said, the defiance even in death, mm-hmm. which was, you know, you have tragedy, but not tragedy. It's tragedy. It's a racist horror that's being inflicted on Emmett Till and on all black people and frankly on all of humanity, that thing. And at the same time, you bring a defiance. You're not begging. Emmett Till wasn't begging. And that's something I thought was really incredibly important in this. So why don't you tell the scene you're going to do. Why don't you do the scene that you were going to do, explain it, okay. And then do the scene.
Okay. Well, this is a scene from the opening. And it basically just, this is Emmett saying that I'm alive. This is here. I'm starting letting you know that I'm talking about my life. Not about my death, about life. Emmett Lewis Till, first class. The birds announce my arrival. Thou didst make me, show me my rival. Brim upturned. Blind Panama straw with a green exotic feather. Still say, Kyle. New pants, never been worn. White bucks, not a scuff on them. New pants, new shoes, man. White bucks, dang. Okay. So you're short and you stutter. Deal with it or let it get in your way.
You know, an incredible, I mean, what you brought to this is just amazing. And people, you have to see how you really, it's radio, so you can't see the face. But if you can see Lorenz's face, it's a really, you know, and I think this is the point about the life, because what you get is, you know, there is a point here of you have all these beautiful children in this society, you know, and especially you look in the inner cities, there's all these beautiful children from oppressed nationalities. And by the time they're 14, their fate is often decided
by
the
society. It's a loss of innocence. It's a loss of innocence. And I think more importantly, I know that with the time, it's about, we have to give free expression to our voice. We have to give, you know, that's part of the thing that I think that our children are not allowed to do. You know, there's three things as a human being that we need. We need to be seen, we need to be nurtured, and we need to feel safe. And I think Emmett Till's story resonates that. And I think our children need to feel that. And right now we're living in a climate where they're not feeling seen and they're not feeling safe. And I think that coming to see Emmett Till is, it's time for him. He's coming back. His spirit is coming back to say, here is how you give free expression to yourself. Don't deny who you are. Mm-hmm. Always stay with who you are. And his voice gave rise to a whole movement, because it was through him and what he did and his mother did that ignited a whole movement. Because 4 months later, Rosa Parks didn't give her seat up off the bus, but she also said that one of the reasons why she thought about what had happened to Emmett Till. So his cry, his voice of not letting his voice be squelched was important.
Lorenz, for you, I mean, you're obviously not that far removed. It's not decades. You're not. I'm not sitting here talking to a 40-year-old guy.
Right.
You know? So how did this resonate with? Because like I said, you embodied so much of it, including, and I'd like to talk about the defiance in the death scene, which is done, actually staged really wonderfully. You know, it's a really incredibly, incredibly moving. It's difficult. You had, now folks, you got to get this. You had five cast members playing about 13 parts, you know, and frankly, a very spare stage. And so even to bring the horror was done in a way that it's on stage, but it's like sort of hanging over it, and it's woven throughout the whole story. How did that take? I mean, that must have been something to look at this again. Like, not just, you know, I'd say another thing people need. They need to be free of all of the kind of oppression.
Absolutely.
And that's, you know, and to me, that's what you brought to the Emmett Till character, even in death. So can you talk about that? Because that's something you couldn't go to the history books and say, oh, Emmett did this. You had to bring some of that. There had to be some of that, bringing that to the story.
You know? Right. Well, I like I said before, you know, I did do research. And in the interview in Look Magazine, they interviewed the people who killed Emmett, and they said they didn't want to kill him. They didn't plan on killing him. They just wanted to whip him a little bit, you know. But he kept talking. He wouldn't shut up. He wouldn't bow down. He wouldn't change who he was for anyone. So they didn't like that. It something snapped inside of him, he said, and he killed him. So what I just really wanted to go there fully. I wanted to try to I took on my parents when they would tell me to, you know, stop doing this, stop doing that. I embodied that. The teacher, when she tells you to stop, you know, I embodied that. And I brought it all, and I said, here, all this that for me personally, I'm going to give it to Milam, the person who was doing the killing.
Also, I have to say that working with Lorenz, he is a really multi-talented. Not only he's a musician and a singer, which he is giving voice, but when I found out that this dance that he does, and he does that, was it crumping that
yes.
you do?
Yeah. Crumping.
And crumping, could you tell me, when I asked you, what is actually crumping when you talk about when there are those competitions? And there's a certain, what did you say, that when each person meets each other at the, mm-hmm. it's almost like warriors.
It is.
And so when I found that out, he already has that warrior spirit in those competitors. So could you talk about that?
Right. Well,
we're doing about 30 seconds.
Yes.
Sure. Well, crumping is pretty much just like you said. It's basically showing each other that I'm not going to back down. It's a warrior. We're fighting, but not physically fighting. It's fighting with our through dance and expression. And the one that comes out on top is the more powerful warrior.
It's an incredibly important play. It's The Ballad of Emmett Till. It's written by Aoife Baeza. It's directed by Shirley Jo Finney. And we've been talking today with Shirley Jo and Lorenz Arnell,
yes.
who plays Emmett Till. It's just a powerful and fantastic play, so no matter where you are, if you can get this play to your city, do so. In these times, a work of art like this can have a very important impact, and often in ways that aren't always so evident. If you want to begin to look beneath the surface, to discover the way things work, this play is part of that process. Plus, it's a beautiful and soaring work of art. Well, that wraps up another show. I want to thank my engineer, Melissa Figueroa, as well as Henry Carson and Age for their production assistance. And most of all, I want to thank all of you for tuning in, and please keep doing so. As we look out on the world today, it's clear to many of us, at least those of us with a heart and an open mind, that the world does cry out for radical change. The big questions are whether it's possible to do it, and if so, how? And even more, what kind of world would we build? That's what I like to think this show is all about, exploring all of this as part of getting there. And that requires all of us digging into this together. I look forward to hearing from all of you, your comments, ideas, and whatever else you want to say. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. Following up on our last segment, we're going to go out with The Ballad of Emmett Till from Blind Boy Grunt, or, as most of the world knows him, Bob Dylan.
Was down in Mississippi. Not so long ago, when a young boy from Chicago town walked through his southern door. This boy's fateful tragedy you should all remember well. The color of his skin was black, and his name was Emmett Till. Some men, they dragged him to a barn, and there they beat him up. They said they had a reason, but I disremember what. They tortured him and did some things too evil to repeat. There was screaming sounds inside the barn. There was laughing sounds out on the street. Then they rolled his body down a gulf amidst death. and I'm sure it ain't no lie. Was just for the fun of killing him and to slowly watch him die. And then to stop the United States of yelling for a trial. Two brothers, they confessed that they had killed poor Emmett Till. But on the jury, there were men who helped the brothers commit this awful crime. And so this trial was a mockery, but nobody seemed to mind. I saw them all in papers, but I could not bear to see the smiling brothers walking down the courthouse stairs. For the jury found them innocent, and the brothers, they went free. While Emmett's body floats a foam of a Jim Crow Southern Sea. If you can't speak out against this kind of thing, the crime that's so unjust, your eyes are filled with dead man's dirt, and your mind is filled with dust. Your arms and legs, they must be in shackles and chains, and your blood, it must refuse to flow for you to let this human race fall down so god-awful low. This song is just a reminder to remind your fellow man that this kind of thing still lives today in that ghost road to Klux Klan. But if all us folks that thinks alike, if we'd give all we could give, we'd make this great land of ours a greater place to live.